Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening for people who are joining in from different parts of the world. And welcome to the Awakening Talk today. And my name is Shruti, and I'm delighted to be your host for Fortnightly Awakening Talk. Thanks for joining us. The purpose of these talks is to share stories that help plant seeds for a more compassionate society while fostering our own inner transformation. We do this by holding collective conversations with guest speakers from all walks of life who inspire us deeply and to live in a more service-oriented way. And behind each of these calls is an entire team of service-based volunteers. We just had a pre-talk party as well, whose invisible work allows us to hold this space. Today, our special guest is Mr. N. Vagul. Thank you for joining today's call, sir. And before we jump in, I'm also really excited to hear about Mr. Vagul. I request that we start our call with a minute of silence to anchor ourselves into this space. Welcome again. And before we begin, now I would like to invite some of our really special, really dear young friends to offer a small song, a prayer to open our conversation.
तेरे मालिक तेरे बंदे हम तेरे मालिक तेरे बंदे हम ऐसे हो हमारे करम नेकी पर चले और बली से डले ताकि हंसते हुए निकले दम ए मालिक तेरे बंदे हम जब जुल्मों का हो सामना तब तू ही हमें थामना जब जुल्मों
Thank you. That was wonderful. Thank you so much. So these are our little angels, Krishali, Anisha, Swapnali, Akash, Aditya, Deeksha, and Rohini. Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Sister Lucy and Yogesh, for coordinating this. These children are from Meher in Pune, and Sister Lucy is actually fondly called as Mother Teresa of Pune. Thank you so much. And after this beautiful blessing, it feels like a perfect way to dive into our conversation with a deeply inspiring guest. And again, thank you so much, Mr. Vagul, for being here in conversation with his long-time mentee, Venkatakrishnan. Our moderator today is Venkat Krishnan, and I'll soon pass it over to him. But before that, just a quick little intro about Venkat. Over the last two decades, Venkat has played a pivotal role in India's development sector. And you all probably would already know about Venkat and his work. He's a mentor to many social entrepreneurs and service entrepreneurs. A lot of people in my friend circle are mentees to him. But something you might not know is this anecdote from his early life. At the age of 21, while studying in one of the India's best B school, Venkat actually wrote in his college assignment that I see myself as an instrument that is available to the society. So I will not do something just because I like it, but because that is the best use of my time for the society's benefit. I will do whatever it takes. Deeply grateful to you, Venkat, for manifesting that balance of intelligence and compassion in the inspiring work that you've done in the last 20, 25 years through Daan Utsav, India Welfare Trust, Living My Promise, and much more. And with this, over to you, Venkat. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Shruti. And absolutely my pleasure to have yet another conversation with Mr. Babul. I have quite a few conversations with him, and I really, really look forward to all of them. I'm not going to really introduce him. I mean, you know, he has a Wikipedia page. You've already seen his introduction there. I am going to just share a small anecdote, which I think is the best way to introduce him. You know, Forbes India was organizing its first India Leadership, Philanthropy Leadership Awards. And Mr. Babul was the chair of the jury. The other members of the jury were, you know, Raghav Dayal of CNBC then. Myself, Madhav Chavan of Pratham, Kiran Mazumdar Shaw, Devi Shetty, founder of Narayan Hridayalaya, and Shashi Tharoor. And we were discussing various candidates, and one of the ideas was to discuss a lifetime achievement award in philanthropy. And some of us suggested that Mr. Babul deserves that award. He was obviously very embarrassed, but we had to force him to recuse himself and leave the room. Which he did finally, very reluctantly. He said, no, this is very awkward. I can't be getting this award, etc. I'm part of the jury. But we managed to convince him to leave the room so that we could deliberate. And it was very interesting. So we went around the room. Raghav Dayal went first. He said, you know, several years, decades ago, when I was about to start my business, nobody in India was willing to give me a loan. We wanted to start India's first production house. Nobody understood that industry, and banks said, we don't know whether we'll get our money back. Mr. Babul was the first person who ever gave me money. He trusted in my ability, believed in me, and whatever I am today is because of him. Kiran Mazumdar Shaw immediately piped up and said, you know, when I was starting Biocon, nobody believed in the potential of what we could do. Mr. Babul was the first person who believed in me, and today whatever I am is because of him. Devi Shetty said exactly the same thing. He said that Mr. Babul supported me in the early stages of my building Narayan Hridayalaya, and I am whatever I am today because of him. Madhav Chavan said the exact same thing. And I can tell you that for me, nothing could be truer than whatever I am today is because of Mr. Babul. It was really ridiculous that 5 out of 6 jury people who were all randomly selected. Mr. Babul had no role to play in selection of that jury. But all of us are whatever we are today because of him. Shashi Tharoor was the only person who was kind of completely nonplussed about what was happening. And we eventually did give the award to Mr. Babul, and he graciously accepted it, although quite reluctantly. So here's the man who has had so much impact on so many people in India. It's just not funny. So, sir, thank you once again for taking out the time today to spend with us. Really grateful again for this opportunity. So I'm going to kick off by asking you a question related to this, right, sir? That all of us somehow felt that you had this deep sense of belief in us. And I've seen this with many, many other young entrepreneurs, social and business entrepreneurs that I've met, that somehow you have this uncanny ability to have deep belief in people and their ability to do good, to be successful, to do good work. Where does this belief come from?
I suppose most of these beliefs come from your own natural upbringing. I remember quite some time back, about more than 50 years back or 55 years back, I was appearing for an interview. I wanted to change my career at the time. And the requirement was that I should give an aptitude test. After the aptitude test was administered and everything was over, that lady who administered that aptitude test to me came to me and said, "Mr. Vogel, can I ask you a question now that the test is over?" "Yes." "Have you ever been betrayed in your life?" I was a bit taken aback. I said, "Why are you asking this?" "Because your aptitude shows that you are too trusting of people. I'm sure that there must be instances in which this trust has been betrayed." Looking back, I found nobody betrayed my trust. I suppose one has to have a feeling that when you trust and have faith in people, that faith and trust is invariably reciprocated. It doesn't matter if things don't work out. But I suppose we have to give precedence to human nature, which is trusting. And more and more, after time has elapsed, I believe that it's not a very special quality. We are all interconnected. And if I don't trust you, it means that I don't trust myself. I suppose as simple as that. I met people, when they come up with ideas, they want to do public good. They are selfless. There is no motive of greed behind that. I invariably put my trust on them. I said, fortunately, I was placed in a position to, for a brief while, to be of help. I mean, it is not a wealth which I acquired. It is the organizational position which I had, which gave me access to something. And I was quite happy to share with those people who were willing to dedicate their lives for public good. And I only look for one characteristic in them, whether there is an element of greed, particularly greed for money. Of course, I did meet some people who were greedy about their recognition and reputation. I would have very much wished that that feature was not there. But I suppose that's something which would grow over time and over age and over experience. So I left it at that. I think public good became my sole motive for trusting people.
Very interesting. But what about in business? Because even in business, so whether it was Devi Shetty, Raghav Vel, Kiran Mazumdar, these were all people who had come to you for business loans. And I know many other people. In fact, you started TDICS, India's first venture capital fund. And you've taken bets on people's businesses at times when nobody would trust them or those industries itself. How did you get that belief in people?
Don't focus so much on me because I am such an insignificant person. This ability, I don't think that is an ability. When people come and meet me, I just look for one character. Everyone must, in order to trust people, look for some characteristic in the other person. And when you, for example, Pirmal, Ajay and others, and they came and wanted me to join them in their business or in their foundation work, I could see transparently that they were, my main concern was, of course, in business, they had to make profit. But their main concern, even in business, is to do public good. To me, it became a motto, namely, anybody who has got a public good as a motive will go on. For example, you were talking about Bahadur Chauhan. I remember I was so busy, and Bahadur used to say that I don't remember very much, that I didn't have much time. And Madhav somehow wanted to spend a few minutes with me and said, "Make a request." So we came and I spent about 5 minutes with him. And he only said this much, that by the turn of the millennium, I want every child in Mumbai to be educated. That was enough to convince me that this is a person who needed support and who had to be trusted. And I was in a position to help him and trust him. These are the two things which bring that connection together. The same way I think it happened with business also. But I suppose the people who approached me are also like that. I mean, there were of course quite a few who approached me whose motive was different, and I could differentiate and said that if their motive is making profit, I'm not interested in that. And I moved on. But I did make some mistakes also interesting other people also. It's not as though that I have an uncanny ability to pick up only the good people.
Right. That's interesting. So, you know, related to trust is this whole issue of compassion. And you've said this several times to me, you've said this several times to people, that compassion has to be the bedrock of our lives and the way we live our lives. How do you reconcile compassion in today's business world, especially where there is, in fact, forget even the business world, even in the non-profit sector now and development sector, there is so much competitiveness, the need to be more successful and visible than others, etc. How do you reconcile these competitive instincts with compassion? How do you make space for compassion and yet be a good, successful organization?
You know, the successful organization need very compassionate leadership. Compassionate leadership is not in a way to be interpreted in a very narrow sense that it is something in which you have love and compassion alone. To me, I think compassion is a much wider concept. I mean, if I can take a few, couple of minutes to explain, there used to be this famous philosophers in mid-19th century, that's around the World War II time, Gurdjieff and Auschwitzky. I think this Auschwitzky developed this concept of three grades of people. One is a mechanistic human being who is rooted in the earth. And second is a balanced person who really moves away from the earth and moves away from senses and thinks in terms of developing a balanced instinct, balancing the sensory pleasures and also the inner space. The third is a spiritual person. Spiritual person is so high. And he said that most of us are privy to the mechanistic thinking process where we really react on the basis of our own programmed learning. We are programmed from the childhood by our parents, by our teachers, by friends, by books which we read, by seminars we attend, quite a lot of things really program us to behave in a particular way. And that really is the lowest form of existence for a human being. People will have to move out of that into the next stage of balanced man. And from that balanced man, one has to move into the spiritual person. Today, if you really look at it, business world, they are all in that mechanistic one. They are catering to their pleasures of and happiness of senses. I mean, in a very broad sense, I'm making sense of making money, sense of winning over people, sensing making some achievement. From then they move into the balance stage. That's the stage of leadership, which you really can call the compassionate leadership. And a long time back in the 19th century, there used to be a famous saint by name Ram Tirtha. He likened this whole concept. I mean, it's so astonishing that what was to be developed in the mid-20th century came to be developed by Ram Tirtha in 19th century. He likened this whole journey to a gilli danda. That is, you place a gilli in the ground and sharpen the edges of the gilli and then use the danda to tap it. And then the gilli rises. And then you hit it and it soars high. The same way life also is about, instead of being rooted in the ground, you move up using your skill. And then when you move up, that is the stage of the balanced man. And from there, you gain heights into these spiritual heights. So the point which I'm making is that today, the right leadership which we need is a person who, I mean, somewhere else I have defined what my concept of balanced person is, a balanced person who has completely eschewed greed, selfishness, and also desire for recognition even. And a person who completely cleans his mind of all negative feelings like anger, hatred, fear, prejudices, jealousy. And the third, develop a feeling of compassion, gratitude. The compassion there is flowing up to the fact, not because of charity or anything like that, not because of obliging somebody. The compassion arises because you feel that you are interconnected, that Venkat and I are not two different persons, but Venkat is the same as me. I am the same as Venkat. I see my reflection in Venkat. So that's compassion to my mind. That type of leadership is the one which can do a lot of good to the society. And today when you ask me about that compassionate leadership, the society is suffering. The business is suffering, not because of lack of policies or strategies, but because people are banning the political leadership, people are banning the business leadership. are not the type of balanced persons that Gurjeev described or Ram Tirtha described, persons who are really moved away from the earth into a position from where they can claim greater heights. I'm feeling that compassion has to be viewed in a very wider concept than merely giving charity or anything like that. Because the English word is so limited that when we talk of compassion, we talk in terms of giving charity or philanthropy. I think it is much more than the philanthropy. It describes the nature of a human being. And that nature of a human being is the one who can lift the society up.
That's very interesting. One more of, you know, and you say don't talk about me, but let me phrase the question a little differently then. You know, today everybody talks about feminism, women leadership, giving women, building a more inclusive society. I remember when I first met you in 2001, some of the senior most people working with you at ICICI Bank at that time, Kalpana Motwarya, Lalita Gupte, Shikha Sharma, Chanda Kochar, Renuka Ramnath, Ramni Narula, you had like more than 50% of the senior management in ICICI Bank were women. Did you do anything different that allowed for these women to thrive in the corporate world at that point of time? I mean, what was your approach that actually created the space for so many women to rise in the bank?
I think I'll answer the question by an event that took place in one of my annual general meeting. I think it was quite some time back, 15 years back maybe, that took place in Baroda. And I was sitting in the stage and shareholders keep on asking questions, making speeches. One Mr. shareholder asked me, what did you do? What good fortune did you do in your previous birth to deserve this luck of being surrounded by such beautiful women on the stage? Because there were about 60% women. And usually this, Mr. Kamath used to reply to these questions. And I told Kamath, this particular question, let me reply because it is addressed to me. And so after Kamath finished his speech, I talked to the shareholder, I mean from the stage. I told him, he asked me a very interesting question, let me reply. Very, very long time back, there used to be a Buddhist monk who was walking along in the jungle when he saw a woman rush past him and then disappear into the right side of the fork way that was there. Immediately following her were a set of thugs who were chasing her, obviously. They stopped at the Buddhist monk and asked the Buddhist monk, did you see a girl run past this side and which way did she go? Buddhist monk lifted up, I saw a human form in flesh and blood run past me. I didn't see whether it was a man or a woman. I didn't even look at where she went. I told the shareholder, when you look at these women, you look at them as women. I don't look at them as women, I look at them as human beings. I look at them as very bright, talented people who have risen up to this particular level by the sheer capability that they have shown in the organizational career. And so this is the difference between your looking at them as women and my looking at them as a human being with talent. The only thing which I did in the organization is not to look at the women in any special way, but look at them as human beings comparable to any other human being I met in the organization, the division. Only thing which I made a difference was that in respect of women, because they have a biological obligation to bring babies into the earth, and they have to be specially treated for the purpose, and an event like that happens, and they have to be specially treated. Beyond that, the only thing that I did in the ICICI organization, to my memory, is to treat them in a neutral way, gender neutral way, and give them the same opportunities and same preferences as I would give to any other employee in the organization. In fact, I concluded my observation to this gentleman and said, you asked me what good fortune I did in the previous birth and what was I in my previous birth to deserve this particular luck. I told him I was that Buddha Bhikshu in that previous birth. And that's how I look at it. I think that what women need is that not any special preference or special treatment. They need it to be treated the same way as men. And that I think somehow it fortuitously happened. The number of women who came to ICICI was, again, because of the fact word must have spread around. It's a good environment to people to work with. And you know, you were in IIM, and I think IIM, the seniors' views really matter a lot. When people tell, okay, this is a good organization to work with, people are comfortable, people are easy, women are particularly comfortable, then more women come to join. And I think one reinforces the other, and it is possible for us to move forward. So I'm very delighted that so many women joined the ICICI, so many women have been moved to great heights in ICICI and also moved out to senior positions and top positions in the organization. And I think all come out of one simple concept, gender neutrality. If you have the gender neutrality, everything else will be possible.
Very interesting, sir. I think most of us would have thought about a bunch of, you know, we all nowadays get believe a lot in affirmative action, proactive steps, etc. But it's very interesting to hear you say that actually more than any of that, all you need to do is to genuinely and honestly be neutral. And perhaps, you know, most of us are not able to do even that. So I have a question related to that, because, you know, we've been hearing some of the positives, your ability to trust people, the compassion you show, treating women as equal, etc. And all of that results in, we've seen many fabulous things. Now, you know, for example, I'm now 51 years old. I have started mentoring a lot of young people. And you've been, of course, mentoring people even older than me for years now. Question for you is, and this is a problem that I struggle a bit with personally, sir, is how do you handle disappointment? In the sense, you see somebody is having potential. You spend a lot of time, engage them, support them. In no way try to influence what they do, but to try and encourage them. But along the way, some of them just don't live up to their potential. They either kind of, you know, hugely underachieve, and often it is not even for it is often for lack of trying. I mean, they just kind of choose not to do the best that they can possibly do. I tend to get very easily disappointed when that happens. It feels almost like I wasted a lot of my time trying to mentor somebody who didn't even seem to be interested in living up to their potential. Has that happened to you, and how do you deal with those situations?
It has happened to me, but I don't waste time on that. I don't think that I ever believed that I had an obligation to improve somebody. Most of my time I went in improving myself. I suppose ultimately influencing another person to behave in a particular way to a large extent would depend on the way in which you influence yourself in behaving a different way. I told you about the concept of the balanced man. Somewhere around my the age of 30s or so, I became convinced, I think, that the only way in which you can influence the environment or influence the organization or influence the people is to improve yourself. And I concentrated very much on improving myself. And when somebody does different, I suppose people have different characteristics, I don't waste my time on him. I mean, I remember in one of the organizations which I created, I appointed somebody, trusted him, made a lot of inquiries about him, and he became leader. And he disappointed me. But I did not waste my time. I just moved on. I picked somebody, and I think whatever I needed to do, help him, I helped him to part from me. And then I moved ahead. I suppose the life is so short for us to think in terms of trying to cope with such situations except through a process of we have to achieve a goal, we have to achieve some objective, so I have to move on. If somebody is not willing to go along with me, what's that famous Bengali song, Ekte Chalo, or something like that? I mean,
Ekla Chalo.
Like that, we'll walk like that. But why are we bothered about it? I think I am very clear in my goal what we should do. That goal is not only a societal goal, it's also a personal goal. There is a personal element involved in it. But at some stage in the mid-career, mid-life, I came to the conclusion that what is good for society is also good for me. That the one that elevates me is the one which elevates the society also. And if I can think in terms of elevating myself from the ground up into the balanced man position where I can control my feelings, control my senses, and control my anger, control my negative feelings, and develop a feeling of compassion, gratitude, and love, that should really take care of everything. And somehow or other, it has worked that way. In my life, I had had very limited experience of people where I can point out and say, this person whom I trusted betrayed me or anything like that. Maybe it's good fortune, maybe otherwise, I don't know. But I developed a strong belief that if you place trust in that person, he invariably reciprocates the trust and comes across the same. There may be some noises here and there, but ultimately I think people do get impressed. And the way in which I got impressed, my own mentor, Mr. Talwar, never taught me anything. He only lived a life which was an example to me. That's why if you live a life which could be an example to people, they will somehow or other imitate you in some form or other. There's no need for us to think in terms of personally influencing any person. You have to take care to influence, to become the authentic person, to become the person you want to be, and then you can spread the influence around.
Nice. Well, I didn't have children. I only hope that I influence more people into not having children on that note. But thanks for mentioning Mr. Talwar, sir. And, you know, I remember many occasions where you told me how you were, you used to admire Mr. Talwar's ability to judge the character of a person in a very short period of time. And this is something I have observed about you too. And many people have said this to you when you were in charge of HR at State Bank and recruitment there, etc., that you have this uncanny ability which your mentor, Mr. Talwar, also had of in 2 or 3 minutes being able to judge the character of a person very quickly with like barely a few sentences spoken. I still struggle. I spend years working with a person and I'm still not sure whether I can, I have a handle over their character. So is there something specific you look for? Is this a teachable skill or is this just a natural gift that you have?
Again, I must go back to about really 65 years. There used to be a gentleman by name K.S.V. Raman, who was an ICS cabinet secretary. And he was the chairman of the recruitment board for State Bank of India. I was in State Bank of India at the time.
Correct.
His selection of State Bank officers used to be very uncanny. I think he brought some of the best and the brightest. And he was nearing his 80s. And I asked the same question to him when I was in my 30s or late 20s. I went all the way to Pune. I still remember his address, 400 Canal Road, Pune. Patna. And I asked him, sir, you somehow picked the right people and you are, even though you are the chairman of the board, you are the only person who was making the choice. How did you pick such people in such a short time of 15 minutes or something like that? Now, I want to learn from you so that I'll be able to cultivate that skill. So he told me, Mr. Vagul, do you know how, have you ever seen identical twins? Yes, I have seen identical twins. Sometimes it's very difficult for you to tell them apart because they're so identical. But does the mother find it difficult to tell them apart? The mother has an uncanny ability to find out this is so-and-so, this is so-and-so. The same way, I think, when you come across a large number of people in your life, when you move with lots of people, it will be possible for you to pick up the right one from the wrong one. You know, you can see in my recruitment board, since I had the full authority, you know the people who surrounded me in the recruitment board, I had 5 or 6 people. They are all college professors or college lecturers or people like that who come into contact with students all the time. These are the people who can discriminate between the good person and the not so good person. There is no such thing person as a bad person, a good person and a not so good person, a person who can deliver, a person who cannot deliver. And so he says it comes as a result of your experience, as a result of your moving with a lot of people and having a positive attitude, it'll be possible for you to pick up the right person. I think that's the answer. There's no natural ability. It comes as a result of your developing a social skill of moving with people and picking up characteristics from them. I don't know, I've been fortunate in this that I not only met with a lot of people, but also the point. And mostly I think the people whom I met, I should be very clear that they are all lovable, compassionate, and I like them all. And everybody, there was hardly anybody who betrayed me, very few people.
Thanks. For our audience today, I will just ask another couple of questions to Mr. Vagul. But in the meantime, if you have any questions, feel free to share them on the Avikin Talks timeline where you're watching this video. And one of our volunteers will relay those questions back to Mr. Vagul today. Sir, you know, you, of course, there is this whole new generation of millennials, as we call them, people in their 20s and 30s. You have your nieces who are and nephews in that age. I remember once you met Ravi Mohan's daughter along with me and you were speaking about her. And from your interactions with these young people, what is your sense of how this generation is different from, say, my generation or older generations? And what do you feel about how do you think they are going to shape the world?
Every new generation is a revelation. I mean, they really excel the previous generation by miles. In fact, this has been happening ever since Socrates' time. The older people generally look down on this young generation because there is going to be differentiated value systems and differentiated approach to society. They believe that they're different. And then I once read something interesting about Socrates. Socrates was saying that what is the new generation coming to, at this rate at which this generation is deteriorating. I don't know whether the world will last for another 100 years. The world did last for 3,000 years and the world is a much better place to live. So when I look at this younger generation, even in India, live alone the rest of the world, I'm amazed at the speed with which they are adapting themselves to and the knowledge which they have. And I mean, I'm amazed that they are far, far ahead than any of the two. I mean, I have spanned about four generations. The new generation, new millennial generation is every one of them whom I come across has a skill which is unmatched by the previous generations. But my only worry is that this skill which they have acquired, skill and knowledge which they have acquired over a period of time, has to be matched by what I called an elevation of an individual, the individual self, moving into a much higher self in values, which can really develop them completely in order to do a better society, evolve a better society. I think this is the only missing link in them. They're bright people, very knowledgeable people, very good people, but somewhere I think they are missing out on this question of the values in life, the not values in a sense that as their obligation to the society. And if that is there, I think we will see a much better place to live in. And the society will be far, far better than what it is now. I don't know. There has to be an intervention in that process. And you and I have been talking about it for several times, that the societal intervention is necessary to convert this brilliance and to this talent into something which is very useful to the rest of the society and to care for people who are downtrodden and who are poor.
Right. Well, that's true. You've seen probably Aditya Nataraj's work with the Gandhi Fellowship. You've seen a lot of young people working with Madhav. I've seen the Teach for India fellows at work with Shaheen. I actually think that the current millennial generation is actually much more socially inclined than my generation was, sir. I think, you know, if I look at my peers and batchmates, etc., we were, you know, much more self-obsessed in terms of creating wealth for ourselves and, you know, living comfortable lifestyles. You know, my average batchmate today will have a Mercedes or an Audi or some other fancy vehicle and, you know, living a very, I would say, indulgent lifestyle in many cases. Whereas many of these young people I see now are actually eschewing mainstream corporate jobs, taking up nonprofit work, even activist work in some cases, putting their careers and lives at risk. So, I mean, my experience on values with the millennials actually is that I think they are far more socially inclined than my generation was. Do you have a different view on that?
No, I don't have a different view, but you know, I don't know how to articulate it in a much more meaningful manner. But they do have a lot of an attachment to the society, and they want to improve the society. I'm really looking at the totality of their person. There are people who are more interested in a narrow sphere of making money and having a little bit of life. There are people like this is emerging in very large numbers who care for the society. But I'm really looking at these people getting developed into a complete human being, where it's not only the achievement of a particular goal in the society or in business that's important, more in terms of developing themselves, moving away from mechanistic thinking process into a higher process, right, in which they become a complete human being. And when they become a complete being, they'll be in a position to influence the society. I mean, I used to tell the story of a person. I mean, if you put the carrot in a boiling water, the carrot becomes squashy. And if you put egg in a boiling water, it becomes hard. Neither of them is very good. People become hardened by certain factors. They are, I mean, influenced by the environment. The environment is the boiling water. But if you put some coffee beans in the boiling water, it spreads an aroma. It spreads an aroma which influences the environment. In the same way, I want these youngsters who are so talented and so social-minded person who are care for the society to move to the next step of becoming compassionate leaders. The compassionate leadership is not only caring for the society, but compassionate leadership of elevating themselves into a higher plane so that they can perform a much bigger role. That's a pretty true. That's the only difference I have.
What a wonderful, wonderful anecdote. It's really, really amazing. So I'll wait to check, Shruti, if you have any questions, do let me know. I have one question for Mr. Vagul, and then we'll see if we have audience questions. Shruti, you can take over. So generally, looking at the state in which especially India is, I mean, of course, the larger world also, and looking at the overall direction of society, so political, economic, all of those aspects, the general tendency for some of us is to feel despondent, is to say things are not going well, we are becoming more restrictive as a society instead of becoming freer as a society, inequality is growing, etc. What is your assessment? Do you, and you know, of course, there are people like you know, Bill Gates and others who will argue that with data that society is consistently getting better with every generation, and that may be factually true, but I think the despair comes from the fact that it's not getting better as fast as we would like it to, given the amount of resources we now have, the kind of people we now have access to. Shouldn't we be able to solve our problems of hunger, poverty, etc. much faster than we are solving them currently? How do you look at the direction in which the world is headed and India is headed? And within that, what gives you hope?
I am despondent. I mean, I am honestly despondent. I believe that despondence is because of a sharp decline in values. The values because one factor, I mean, I told you, but series of factors which really are necessary for the purpose of evolving of a person. The simple fact of greed, the simple fact of greed for power, greed for money, has really robbed the society of its only charm. And what happens is, well, there are lots of good people around. They are not in a position to organize themselves. I kept on articulating this point for the last 30 years for no while. Even in the social space, and say there is Pratham, there is a Premji Foundation, there is a Paramal Foundation, a whole lot of foundations on education and health. You know, could it not have been possible for all of us to come together in order to make a powerful impact on the society, in order to improve the society? Because all of us are in a separate world, and that's where I think my despondency comes. I sometimes wonder, I think we should set aside all these personal differences. We may, even in social space, there are differences with which way you can do things, which way you should avoid doing things. But if we all come together in a team, the right-minded people, we can make a very powerful impact on the society. And I think I come across in my 30, 40 years of working in the social space, hundreds and thousands of people, so well-meaning people who can really think differently. And despondency arises from the fact that we somehow are not able to come together and work together for a common good. We all want to work in our own individual space. That's a real problem which I am facing. I do not know if we are really able to work on this, we should be able to bring about a great improvement in the society. Somehow I think people still look at compassion, or give one particular example, compassion. People look at compassion as something equivalent to charity. And the charity is sometimes very selfish. You go and give charity only because you want to establish your name. You want to establish yourself in that, or you believe according to your tradition that you will get punya. But compassion is something very different. Compassion is a very highly spiritual concept which people do not understand. And the compassionate way of living, if you really look at Ikigai or something like that, then there is no person who is a stranger to you. Everybody is your friend. Your friend because you feel that you are connected with him. That concept is still not being able to come. And I believe that if all of us come together and then work in that space, we can bring about a transformation. And the last few months have shown that it is not necessary for us to come into physical contact with each other to be in the physical space. I think even in a virtual space like this, where we are able to interact with each other, we can exchange ideas and say that how best we can really think in terms of coming together and chalking out a path. And we should be able to climb this mountain. Yes, I believe that I am despondent like you for the country, and but I don't know that whether it's possible for all of us to come together in one space and try to think of something in order to transform this society.
Right. Thanks, sir. Sir, I would, of course, love to continue, but I think we have a lot of questions from the audience. So with your permission, sir, I'll request Shruti to share some of the audience questions with you now, sir. And of course, I'll be more than happy to catch up with you later.
Thank you, Venkat. Thank you, Vagul, sir. I could go on listening and this being really deeply inspiring. Thank you so much. One of the things that, you know, I have a habit of taking visual notes while in conversation, and one of the visuals that came alive for me while both of you were talking was this single dot and how this dot is connected to everything around, and the DNA of these dots is so similar, and that is what fosters these connections. And for me, that was the guiding factor that you spoke about around gender, around diversity, around age, around compassion. So that was really beautiful. Thank you. So there have been a flood of comments, sir, from the audience, and a lot of questions, mostly around the themes of spirituality, compassion, and business. So I'll just take a few questions. One of the questions is, sir, around your life. You know, you've had tremendous success in your life from an early age. And then looking back, what would you say were one or two most satisfying moments of your life? And second is, if you were to just debunk one myth about success to all the people who are listening in, what would that be?
No, there's several satisfying moments, but the key to the whole thing is the fact that my mentor taught me, don't seek anything in life. Let things happen to you. I mean, I don't know whether I should tell you this. There is a story of pencil. I don't know whether you heard of that. The story of the pencil is the grandmother was writing in the pencil and the grandson was watching. And so the grandson asked the grandmother, what is it you are writing, grandma? No, whatever writing is not important. This pencil with which I am writing is important. So what is special about this pencil? I want you to be like this pencil. Then grandson said, I don't, this pencil is no different from any other pencil I have seen. What is that you want me to do? See, when I write this pencil, the pencil thinks it writes. But the pencil should realize there is a hand that holds it in order to write it. So you should also realize that when you are living, you should realize there is some hand which is guiding you in that field, so you are not functioning on your own. And secondly, periodically I take that sharpener and sharpen this pencil in order to make it more effective. So you are going to get suffering in your life, and that suffering is in order to sharpen you, in order to make you much better than before. The third important thing that can happen to a pencil is that there is an eraser at the back. And if ever you make a mistake, you can erase it and then move forward. So in life, don't stop at the mistakes that you make. You think in terms of rectifying the mistakes and move forward. And fourth, I think important, the pencil sometimes can be misled into believing that the wooden covering is the pencil. The wooden covering is not the pencil, but the graphite inside the pencil, the wooden covering is the pencil. The same way, you should realize your body is not you, but something inside your body which you cannot see is the real you. And lastly, I think whatever you do, whatever the pencil does, it leaves a mark in the paper. The same way, whatever you do life in your life, either thought, word, or deed, it leaves a mark in your life, and you should always bear it in mind whenever you engage in thought, word, and deed. So I used to have that type of thing, that's most satisfying thing when I read it, that yes, I am not the one who is doing that. My mentor taught me, it seemed to be illogical at that point of time. Don't seek anything in life. Somebody is guiding your life. Somebody is moving forward. You merely listen to him and then you move forward. And when you make a mistake, don't attribute it to him. You attribute it to yourself and then you correct yourself and move forward. I think following this has been a very satisfying moment in my life. And I think overall that did me a lot of good. And I am very much influenced by that way of thinking.
Thank you, sir. Wow, that was beautiful. You have this amazing way of making one feel significant yet insignificant at the same time. And it's almost like, you know, you hear about duality becoming a singularity. And I could sense that. Thank you so much. There's another question, and it's again one of the things that I've added on to the audience question, like my personal thing. Traditionally, you know, businesses are seen as competitive, and I come from both. I've worked for a while in corporate and I worked for a while in the development sector. And in the development sector, there's this entire difference around looking at working together and being very collaborative. Like in both the sides, how do you, one, the question is, one, can competition really be compassionate? Because I love how in sports, they use competition as actually serving each other, right? It's only when I can be the best, am I serving my opponent, and my opponent is doing the same to me. So that is one. And second, like one is that, you know, like you've been talking a lot about role of an individual and how if I manifest the best possible form of myself, I'm doing the ultimate good to the society. But in any business or in any organization, there's this group of individuals, a collective that comes together. Now, how can you use that collective force to be really the force for good or to increasing and serving the society while being true to yourself also?
Again, it comes back to the whole, this question was asked long time back, 50 years back, mm-hmm. in IIM conferences I'm making. Mm-hmm. Same person was saying that, okay, all talk about, those days I used to talk about this quite often, but you elevate yourself and the rest of it really takes care of itself. I mean, ultimately, you don't look at this that I have to take care of him, take care of him, or I have to solve this problem. Problems get solved when you elevate yourself. In fact, I have lots of personal experiences where I found mm-hmm. that when I was boxed into a particular corner, I could come out of it only by thinking, not about the problem, about myself. I think there's something wrong with me. I have to work on that and the problem gets resolved. The same way, I think competition, you'll have to look at it from the point of view of achieving efficiency rather than destroying somebody. We come back to the same spiritual thought. The moment you have a negative feeling that I want to destroy this person in order to improve myself, I think that really is a negative factor. The moment you think that this competition is for the purpose of improving efficiency, to improving innovation, I think that makes a very entirely different environment. So I don't make a difference that competition is in any way bad or anything like that. I think competition is extremely good. I mean, any society you can think in terms of transforming, if you have the good intentions and if you have the positive thinking, and if you believe that the human nature will have to be somewhat different from its base instinct. That is why I am more and more influenced as I go into the sunset stage of my life, that the key aspect of existence will have to be discover the purpose of life. And the purpose of life is to show that level of compassion. And that level of compassion which you show is not inconsistent with any other walk of life. Say, can I be, somebody asked me when I finished a lecture like this, said that you say compassion, if whatever somebody makes a mistake, can't you be angry, can't you punish? But you can punish with a lot of compassion. I mean, there is nothing, compassion is not as though that you have to be, you have to be different. That is your natural self. I see even in a society, whether it is a communist society or is a capitalist society or a competitive society, people will have to be, have as a goal that this society will have to be improved. That means that competition will have to be for the benefit of the society. And once you inherit and you have the spirit, then everything else will work out. I believe that competition can be very functional.
That was a nice perspective for me. So you, when you speak about compassion, and you've been speaking about compassion towards other, and I'm really still living that image of, you know, how I see yourself in me and how you see, the minute I start seeing myself in others, the whole interconnectedness and the nature of compassion changes. But through these years, right, how do you hold compassion for your own self? Like these days, there's so much of talk around burnout, and there is so much of conversation around people, especially in development sector, you know, the, like young people come in and they start experiencing a lot of anxiety, a lot of burnout, a lot of depression. So just asking about, through all those years, you've seen so many sides, you've seen the politics, you've seen the business, you've seen self, and you talk about spirituality. What is it that helps you being compassionate to your own self?
Yeah, I mean, in Ayurveda or some other medicine, they give you some medicine, which is supposed an all-purpose medicine. But this medicine, you take it, you, in COVID time, I've seen, why are you bothered about COVID? You improve your immunity, everything will take care of itself. Then immunity is the key to the whole thing. So one way in which you can contend with the whole situations in life, various situations in life, is to improve your immunity. Your immunity comes as a result of you are developing yourself. Once you decide that I am going to be not bothered about greed, I'm not going to be very bothered about the recognition of people, I mean, other people's views of me or recognition, but I'm going to be an authentic individual. And I'm going to completely eschew any negative feelings in me. And I have identified my negative feelings, anger, hatred, jealousy, prejudice, arrogance, pride. And then think in terms of cultivating the 3 or 4 positive traits, namely the gratitude and the compassion. Compassion in a much broader sense, not in the form of charity. I don't know that what can really have to put, because compassion to my mind is the key to the very existence of life. Sometimes I believe that we come into the world only to learn the thought of comparison. And when we do not completely learn the thought of compassion, then we come back again and again to complete the education. That's at least the way in which the Hindu Dharma really looks at it. And so you concentrate in yourself. In fact, I must tell you this incident that you asked me this question. As about 30, 40 years back, there was a young girl, a 9-year-old girl. She used to talk spiritualism. And I was so fascinated by her. And I mean, she was not, she did not study any scriptures or anything like that, but she could quote from Upanishads, she quote from various religious texts, and she was a gifted child. I don't know what happened to her now, but that brief period when she had that, so many masters used to speak through her. I mean, it was a very vivid experience for me. So I was sitting with her, and she asked me, Mr. Vogel, you seem to be troubled. And something is bothering. Yes, something serious about my organization is bothering me. And I don't know what to do. She said, there is no problem in the organization. Then I looked up and said, why do you say so? My master says the problem is with you. You take care of you, the organization problem will take care of itself. And that was a very interesting comment. I mean, that happened as about 35 years back. I look back and said that the key to the whole problem that which you posed, how do you really take care of this? So the key is within you. You take care of yourself. You look at the problem. In fact, that particular problem which I faced, since I believed intractable, and I think that is going to make a course change in my organization and my career, it got solved. Because the moment I realized I am looking at the problem as me and the other, it's not my way. I have lots of things to do myself in order to improve myself. It's a very complicated process, that way in which you improve yourself in order to solve a particular problem. And that girl, little girl, then 9-year-old girl, put this idea into me. Take care of yourself. And like that, there have been so many learning experiences in my life, which says the focus will be allowed to be on you. I mean, it's the same thing like Gandhi said, that if you want to change the world, you have to change yourself. And it's not as though that you are there to change the environment. You change yourself and the environment will change automatically. So, and that's continues to be my belief now.
Thank you, sir. I'll just going deeper into this only, right? And then also corresponding it with different aspects in your life. Like, so for many years, you've worked across so many organizations, specifically even development organizations, to reduce suffering and poverty in India. And now you said that at the evening of my life, with no persons to meet, no work to do, and no contact with social organizations, I continue the journey in quiet meditation in search of the same goal. So one, can you talk about this transition, which I think you started touching upon? And between really large scale, you know, you have this access to power. And like you said, a lot of things happen because of the opportunity and the access that you have. To now, you know, you're spending time with your pure being. One, how does that transition feel like? And the goal that you spoke about, what is that goal?
No, the goal is to search the true meaning of my life. In my 20s, I started reading a lot of books. In fact, the amount of books which I read is nobody can even think of. I read about all religions, the Hindu religion, the Christian religion, the Sufis. I was fascinated by the Sufis. I was fascinated by people like Rumi and their Kabir and everybody. I thought that I would be able to find an answer to some of my questions by reading books, by intellectual understanding. And then something opened up, which is not so much by interest or understanding, by intellect that you will be able to reach it, you'll have to be by a different path. Then there were saints who put me in the different path. And as I did mention to Rohit about the influence I had on Vipassana, Vipassana did the meditation. And so you cannot find the truth in books. You cannot find truth in discourses. I mean, you cannot find truth even in prayers. My mentor, Mr. Talwar, had a simple concept that I am only an instrument. I surrender myself to the divine and whatever divine tells me, I follow. I used to ask him the question, how do you know that it is the divine command? How do you know it is not a human command? So this debate I used to have. At some point in my life, I decided, no, this is not going to work. You cannot achieve truth by debating. You cannot achieve by talking. You cannot achieve truth by listening. You have to do that. I became very strongly influenced by the Buddhist concept, the Zen concept, in which it said that you find the inner space within you. There is a silent space within you. Continuously give message. Try to understand. This thing cannot be explained. This thing cannot be intellectualized. This cannot be articulated. This can only be experienced. That experience will mean you have to, like what Sufis say, you have to clean up your mind completely of all the dirt. Because the dirt is really preventing you from seeing things as they are. Once you clean up your mind, once you clear your mind from all these dirts, and they call it what you call the doctrine of yellow cloth. When a cloth is full of dirt, its color changes. But the moment you take the soap and start washing it, the whiteness really shows by way of a contrast. So I started experiencing some of these things in my life. And today I find that I used to meet people, I enjoy their acquaintance. I used to find comfort in them. And I used to find comfort in the fact that they are related to me. We all come from the same stock. We all have the same universal consciousness that penetrates. He's a part of it, I am part of it. I'm sitting alone. I'm looking for that inner space within me, which can really talk to me, which can tell me who I am, what for I have come. Is it possible for me to understand that? This journey goes on. And I think this journey is a very difficult journey, like climbing a mountain. I don't know. I mean, this is a journey where we don't know the destination. You don't know whether I arrived at the destination or not. You continuously go on and on. But I don't know what it would be like. But this is what I am doing most of the time, sitting and talking to myself, looking at me. And recently there's a very interesting book by Eckhart Tolle, in which he says that the space within, the silent space within, you look for that silence. I enjoyed the beginning which you had, a 5-minute silence. Ultimately, you have to become silent. You have to become silent in order to hear that message, hear that understanding. That silence is something which is golden. And you do it more and more often. Silence will be in reflection. Sometimes the thoughts will have to end. There will be no thought. There will be no words. Nothing is there except you as a being. And then that can speak louder than anything else. This is what I do now.
Thank you. I feel a lot of silence and stillness even when you're talking and even when we're talking. So can really feel what you're saying. Thank you. A lot of questions are coming from the audience also, sir, specifically, like, it's in the same vein, but specifically, if you were to, you know, if there's a message or if you're speaking to one, the leaders of today, and specifically like civil society leaders, there is this urge to come first. There's this urge to, again, do something very large scale. So one, any specific message you touched upon your feeling about Indian society right now and how you're feeling about it. So specifically to civil society organization leaders and leaders in general, is there any particular message that you have and you would want to convey? Yeah.
My message is very simple. Like-minded people will have to come together. An individual will not be in a position to achieve a lot. Individual will be in a position to achieve something that's satisfying to him, but may not be satisfying to the society. If you really want to make an impact on the society, like-minded people and good people will have to come together and think in terms of working. Because there's so many adverse influences surrounding you, because the balance in the society has been tilted. There was a time possibly in India where the number of good people were more than the number of not so good people. I don't want to say bad people. But today the balance has tilted so much. You have reached a stage where in every walk of life, it is in politics or education or politics and business everywhere, what you see is the grabbing for power and greed is so much predominant that the people who are the silent minority is not wanting to talk. The silent minority is merely watching what is really taking place in the environment and says, I am powerless to do anything because there is corruption everywhere. You can't get anything done in the government without corruption. So you pay the money, you flow along with the stream. This attitude will have to be changed. That is why I think it's necessary for people will have to come together and discuss. This is one important event that you have in the Awaken Talks, where we have an opportunity to exchange views. I'm sure there will be people who will say that, no, what Mr. Bhagwan says doesn't make sense at all. It's good. We have to sit together and say that, because one individual cannot convey that my experience is the only experience which can really flourish. So the opportunity for exchanging ideas and coming out of these discussions, something good that can happen, and we can bind ourselves together in order to work together, that is going to make a powerful impact. That's the only message I can think in terms of giving to the society leaders.
Great. So suddenly the audience channel is very active, and then someone has actually just asked a question related to this, which is, so when you're saying that people need to come together, like that's really critically important and how might this be done? And you know, when you're talking about spirituality again, how do you think can spirituality be actually effectively integrated into business? Because our scriptures talk about of being in service, but that understanding is not commonly seen in business.
No, spirituality is essentially, I can dilate on that, but I'm coming back to my theme. Spirituality and compassion are not two different things. They are the same. Yeah. And you must have read recently, because of my age and all that, I read a lot about the near-death syndrome or out-of-the-world syndrome. Scientists, of course, rubbish them that this is absolutely no truth in that. But there are some events that have been narrated which seem to be far too authentic for us to completely discard. I think you must have seen Dying to Be Me by Anita Murjani or Alexander, The Proof of Heaven. These are all very classic instances of people moving out of this world into another world and come back. Anyway, I am not on that. I am on that, but the entire near-death experience is one thing that cuts out. Is when they come and tell, what is the learning that you learned when you move out of this and then come back to this? It's one word, compassion. So that word compassion runs right across. There may be differences in the experiences of these people when they really move out. But this is somehow or other seems to be like a steady stream right through. So to my mind, the spiritualism, compassion, and the society are not very distinguishable. In a sense, they are all gelded together. So spiritualism is not merely going to the temple or reading books or attending discourses. Spiritualism is a way of life. Spiritualism engenders compassion. That engenders improvement of the society. When you see somebody who is deprived, that suffering you share that suffering, because this is not his suffering, it is your suffering as well. That's the way in which I think I view the spiritualism and compassion and working for the society. So I believe that when I see somebody who has similar views in respect of the societal view, namely that we have to alleviate the sufferings of the people, I want to join hands with him. Come on, let us work together. And I suppose many people come together and then work. I think we can make a difference in the world. This is my view. It's not talking about a religious minority or anything. All these things make no sense at all to me. When you really think in terms of a much broader view, that humanity, recently, about 2-3 weeks back, I read a book which is very interesting about consciousness in plants. And I never believed that the trees sometimes show compassion. There is a tree and then there's an offspring, which is X. And the scientists have discovered that the tree, when it experiences that suffering of that offspring, it is able to extend its roots in order to bring water, in order to nurture that plant, so that the plant can grow into a tree. That is the way in which I think the universe has been created. So this society, this compassion is not only for the living beings, but also for what we believe is the inanimate things like plants and trees, and I think they show the compassion. So I believe that trees do come together in order to nurture their young, to take care of the plant which is in need of water. They are able to produce water to the roots and then give it to them. I believe that we can work together. And I don't know whether individually we can really make a difference in the society today, because the amount of adverse influences is very, very large. I think the good people will have to come together.
Yeah, I recently also read about this whole nature thing and how trees actually have offsprings and grandparents, and that was such a beautiful read. And suddenly my whole perspective of going in forest, thankfully I live very close to nature, completely changed. It was almost like I'm seeing them as family and so nurturing. Thank you for bringing that. So while, sir, we're talking about, this whole aspect of one collective compassion and things, and I think intuitively as humans, we are designed and we understand it, but still there is something that stops us. So again, as a society, in the long term, what do you think are the two big challenges that we need to focus on and we need to be conscious of keeping the long-term well-being of our society in our mind? And again, also your thoughts on how can we address them?
Again, I mean, we are now in around the Industrial Revolution time that Protestants came out with a new concept like human nature, I mean, type of rights, individual rights, freedom, thoughts, experience. That's virtually a sort of a reformation that really took place around the 18th century. Something like that, there has to be a reformation in the world systems in the current world. Just as we talked in terms of abolition of the greed for an individual, nations and societies are also displaying that sub amount of greed. And as a result of which, we still are not able to come together to view the humanity as one whole. We look at humanity in parts, rather in United States societies as different societies. I think the one way in which we have to move ourselves to addressing this issue, some of the pettiness which has to be somehow or other powerfully fought. Like, for example, in India, if we really look at it, if we confine your particular space, I just can't understand differences that exist, the one person and another person. The elections are going on in my state, in Tamil Nadu. Everything is based on caste. People don't talk in terms of human being. A human being is being. I don't know why a leader doesn't emerge that this is silly, this is stupid. This is not the way in which one has to really think about it. And there is enough in the society in order for everybody to share. And why are we really being greedy? Why is money playing so much of an important part in the elections? Like that, I think I can go on multiplying, but we should be in a position to address this. I come back to this, my original theme. If you attack this greed as the major flaw or the major feature which will have to be eradicated, society will be better off by that. Many of the problems that can really be resolved. And the greed by a few individuals really percolates into the society as a whole. The society as a whole gets corrupted. I believe that we should be in a position to address this issue by individual improvement. I am again coming back to my theme that you have to improve yourself. I mean, I want to do something. I may reach that point. I don't think, I mean, I always used to, Benjamin Franklin once said that he wanted to have a goal of avoiding pride. And then he felt so comfortable that when he overcame, reached that objective and he was able to overcome that pride, sitting back and was reflecting, I said, you know, am I not getting a pride that I have overcome the pride? That itself is a pride for me. That suddenly I get a feeling I'm so proud of the fact that I've been able to overcome pride. So how am I going to eschew that? Like that, you know, the process of self-improvement keeps going on and on. You find a little flaw here, little flaw there. I thought that I'd overcome anger. Suddenly I became angry. It is not necessary for you to express anger in order to become angry. Internally, when you become angry, that this is what is happening. That itself is an anger that destroys me. So this is a keep on, you are learning every day. And when you improve yourself, I suppose you attract people with like-minded beliefs and you will be able to improve the society.
Thank you, sir. It's already 11:20 and I'm mindful of time. Hope you're feeling okay. Like, we would love to continue and have a lot of questions, but just wanted to check in with you. Are you good to take a few more questions?
Yeah, I'm quite fine.
Okay, great. So just one very different question. Like, there are tons of questions going deeper into this only. One is, so while when you're saying about this collective work, right, what do you think really leads to such deep relationships that can help collaboration or that can help people to come together and work together? How can I, as an individual, also deepen relationships and motivate myself and others to come together and work together for benefit of society?
I'm sure that there will be a lot of opportunities once, you know, today we are in a technological age where I would never have come into contact with you in my life. I mean, yes. I would not have known you at all. But thanks to this virtual space that has been created, I come into contact. I don't know how many people are there. I'm able to talk to them, but unfortunately, I'm not able to listen to them, what they speak. But I suppose this exchange of ideas, this exchange of views, and there'll be plenty of views from that side also, which can influence me, which will bring us together and say, find some solution somewhere, that this is what we need to do. I mean, some mantra which says that this is the way in which you have to come, that would emerge in respect to that. So collaboration would really mean that we are in any way, as I said, that we are interlinked. That interlinking will have to become a little more advanced and we'll have to come together. And previously, we traveled a lot in order to come together. I mean, in several, two, three organizations which are working for the same purpose like education, I used to move around and tell them, why don't you get together so that we can make a powerful impact. People always used to say, no, they are different, they are different. I'm following a different path, they are following a different path. I think all of us are following one path of educating that deprived person, helping the deprived person. So why don't we come together and think in terms of exchanging ideas and do it collectively so that it becomes very strong? I suppose we have to bring about some change in the attitude of people. Namely, that I alone can do that. That there are people that who are similar-minded persons, so you don't mistrust them. That is why I said in the beginning when talking to Venkat, I generally trust people on the basis of what they say by way of public good. My only misgiving is that people who have abolished greed for money, they have not been able to abolish the greed for recognition. And many people do it for recognition and we think that it is not greed. Greed for recognition is also a greed. Just greed for money is a fair greed. The moment you give up your greed for recognition, then you bring into a collaborative approach. Because I don't need to be put myself in the front. I only want that purpose to be achieved. So I'm prepared to work as a team with everybody. The team gets preferred. Like in cricket, yesterday we won that match in T20. And the team would be proud of the fact that we achieved it. Even though individuals may be also proud of the fact that they achieved something in that. But the smiling faces of all those youngsters who were there in that field, saying that we were able to achieve that. That type of achievement would be possible if individuals emerge. I had a person like Gandhi who said that he was able to rally people around. And before Gandhi, it would have been difficult for people to imagine that in a country as diverse as India, it would be possible for someone to rally people to a common good. And it took a long time for him to achieve that. But he was able to do that because he never craved for recognition himself. I think he let it happen. The same way, I suppose, we will all have to cultivate this habit that my individual self is not important. I don't exist, in fact. I mean, today I exist, tomorrow I will move away. But the collective endeavor will have to continue. This will have to be passed on from generation to generation. Key will have to emerge.
Great. Just last question, sir, and then I'll hand over to Venkat. On this topic of when you're saying that, you know, greed for recognition has to let go of a collaborative and completely in line with that. But so on the topic of recognition and money and power, you know, when do you think there is a social utility for it? And then can that really be manifested and taken and used in a positive way? Like otherwise, like money and power have also become synonymous with this negative things, right? So how, one, what do you feel about money and power? And two, how do you, in your experience, and what are the things that you've done which help you use it for good and for positivity?
That I would give credit to Venkat. Venkat showed the way in which it can be done. Venkat was able to come up periodically with a whole lot of ideas. Namely, that people who have been saying that, okay, I have the feeling in order to do that, but I don't know how to do that. Because my mind stops thinking when it comes to that. Can somebody help me? And Venkat was the person who was able to bring the whole thing. And one of the reasons why I got enchanted with the organization which he created, Give India, is that it gives you a way in which you can really achieve your basic instinct, the basic instinct of improving the society. You don't need to fight for, can I do this, can I do this, can I do that? I think there are umpteen ways in which you can really bring about it. That's exactly the path that Venkat was able to chart out. And that's the way in which we do it. I mean, sometimes we have the money, sometimes we have, and for those people who don't have the money, Venkat has recently started what is called volunteering. Now, I don't have a rupee to give, but I have my body to give. I have my skill, I mean, power, muscle power to help. So I'm able to offer that. If people are able to be motivated by that amount of thought, it is money or your own volunteering. These are the ways in which people like Venkat, with very differentiated thinking, have been able to bring about improvement in the society. And that's one of the reasons why when Venkat asked me this question, how do you get attracted to people? You get attracted to people because Venkat has nothing. He doesn't bother about his own career, his own life. He has sacrificed his life, his own career. Compared to that, I have nothing. I mean, I continued to be looking after my career and started building my institution. But Venkat has completely, and I used to ask Venkat, he's a blessed person. He never married also. He said this is not important for me, society is more important. But because of that, he was able to come up with newer and newer ideas. And he's just beginning to come up with new ideas. He is somewhere in the middle, I can say. He's only in his 40s. He has a long way to go. And people like him would make a lot of difference in society. And then, so we would not be wanting in ideas. I mean, whenever I meet some people on this, I'm enchanted at the number of innovative ideas they throw in order to bring the society. But I always used to say, why can't we all meet together and think in terms of doing something?
Thank you, sir. That is beautiful and perfect opportunity to hand over to Venkat.
Thank you, Shruti. Sir, one last question before we kind of wind up. Really, really grateful to you for all the time you've taken out today. You kind of covered a lot of ground, and coincidentally, the song they played at the beginning, I am Malik Tere Bande Hum, is from V. Shantaram's movie called Dhua Ke Bharahat, and I'll talk to you more about it. But the essence of the song is essentially about how can we become better human beings, which has been the theme of everything that you've said today. They missed out one very powerful paragraph in the song. I'll send you the song later, sir, and discuss it with you as well. It has had huge influence on me personally in my life. But just trying to, you know, help us summarize, there's a large number of people from the corporate world, social sector, young, old, etc., listening to you today. So as we wrap up, is there any one last message you want to leave for all of us?
Somehow or other, at this stage of my life, I can give only one message. Constantly think in terms of self-improvement. Move away from the ground, and then like the gilly, go up. The only way in which the gilly can go up is it can sharpen its intellect and they sharpen the edge. The same way you have to sharpen the intellect and use your powerful instinct like the danda in order to tap it, and then it will go up. And when it goes up, it is easier for you to ascend great heights. So self-improvement is the only key, and you constantly look at yourself, whether I have moved one step forward in my thought process. I have a template before me. A template for me is very simple. One is greed and selfishness is where to go. And then I have to overcome my negative feelings. I have to cultivate my positive feelings. And if I have that mind, that move into the last question, ask that question, who am I? Why am I here? What is my purpose? Then when I come to the purpose, I move into that circle. When I achieve that circle that I am part of this interconnected world, then I have no selfishness. So the circle becomes complete. So that's the only message. Improve. Think in terms of improving yourself. Think in terms, then the rest of the things will follow automatically.
Thank you, sir. Thank you really, really so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Rahul, over to you. I think we're wrapping up with a song.
Thank you so much, sir, and for this wonderful conversation. And it is my privilege to offer this prayer as a closing to this conversation, in which we are just dedicating, like Babul sir said, all our merits to the rest of the world and allowing this love to spread. Thank you so much. May the love we are sharing spread its wings and fly across the earth and bring new joy to every soul that is alive. May the love we are sharing spread its wings and fly across the earth and bring new joy to every soul that is alive. May the blessings of your wings, my Lord, shine on everyone, and may we all see the light within, within, within. May the blessings of your wings, my Lord, shine on everyone, and may we all see the light within, within, within. Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. May all the beings and all the worlds be happy. Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. May all the beings and all the worlds be happy. May the love we are sharing spread its wings and fly across the earth and bring new joy to every soul that is alive. May the blessings of your wings, my Lord, shine on everyone, and may we all see the light within, within, within. Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. May all the beings in all the worlds be happy. Loka samasta sukhino bhavantu. May all the beings and all the worlds be happy. May all the beings and all the worlds be happy.
Thank you, Rahul. We'll just observe a minute of silence before we close.
Thank you for listening to a recording of Awaken Calls. To access archives, visit us at www.awaken.org. And to get more involved, volunteer at www.servicespace.org.